In this way, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu contributed the greatest benefit to the people of East Bengal by initiating them into Harinam, the chanting of the Hare Krishna Mahamantra, and making them learned scholars by educating them. Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Following in the footsteps of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Krishna consciousness movement is distributing the Hare Krishna Mahamantra and inducing people all over the world to chant. We are giving people an immense treasury of transcendental literature translated into all the important languages of the world. And by the grace of Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, this literature is selling profusely. And people are chanting the Hare Krishna Mahamantra with great delight. This is the preaching process of the Chaitanya cult. Since the Lord wanted this cult preached all over the world, the International Society of Krishna Consciousness is acting in a humble way so that the vision of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu may be fulfilled all over the world, especially in the Western countries. Om Agyanti Mirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Gadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yata Padakamalam Sri Gurum Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagarjatam Sahagna Raghunatam Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sarvadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagnaram Sri Vishakam Vitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Tapta Kanchana Gorangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpa Trubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Abhevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shrivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
So do we have to finish by 8:30 today as well? What time do we have until? 9:00. Okay, so there's plenty of time for discussion, which is good. All right, so, and also we're fasting today till 12. Everybody's fasting for Sita Thakurani's appearance. Is that right? Okay. Well, it's Sita Thakurani's appearance day today. It's Advaita Acharya's consort. So I think normally we fast till 12. I wanted to ask, is there anybody here who's been in Krishna consciousness less than 6 months? Or is new? Anybody here who's never read the Chaitanya Charitamrita? Okay, so I will just give you a little bit of background. So Chaitanya Charitamrita, as the name suggests, is the nectar of Lord Chaitanya's pastimes. And we are, the book we're on is the Adi Leela. So Adi Leela is the beginning. There's Adi, Madhyam, and Antya Leela. So his life story, his activities is split into three parts. So the Adi Leela is the first portion of, I guess, the first third of his life. And this chapter, at the beginning of all the chapters, Srila Prabhupada gives us a very nice summary of what happens in that chapter. See, because Prabhupada's been very thorough with all of his books. He gives us the actual language it's written in, whether it's Bengali or Sanskrit. He gives us a word-for-word transliteration. And then he also gives translation and purport. And what can sometimes happen is you can get lost in the actual conversation or the story when we're stopping reading all the purports. So he gives us a nice summary at the start of each chapter. So this particular chapter covers Lord Chaitanya's Kishore age, which is early teenage years, and some of the pastimes in those early teenage years. And the section that we're on at the moment talks about Lord Chaitanya's interactions with Tapan Mishra and how he educates him and actually induces him into the bhakti process. Because what's unusual and special about Lord Chaitanya as an incarnation or avatar of Krishna is that all the other incarnations, they come with weapons to annihilate the demons. And Lord Chaitanya comes to annihilate demons too, but he annihilates them with the weapon of love. So, you know, especially these days, everybody likes to talk about love. But in CC, we hear about really how love in action works. So, again, you know, because we cover CC just at the weekends, we can sometimes get lost with what's happening. So far, over the last few weeks, the last couple of weekends, since Lord Chaitanya's interactions with Tapan Mishra have begun, explained how he has given Tapan Mishra the three things that are very important in our Krishna consciousness. Is it's our knowledge of our relationship with Krishna and the goal of this process, but also the activities of the process. So just in summary, for those of you who maybe missed previous classes, so this knowledge of our relationship with Krishna is understood to be sambandha gyan. Sambandha means relationship, and it has two aspects. One is one which stands for all living entities all of the time, is whether we are here or in the spiritual world, is that we are always Krishna's servant. But being Krishna's servant and being part of him means we can, but being a small part of him, like him, but like a spark is part of a fire, same as the fire, but because smaller in quantity, it has different attributes in some ways, it's easier to put out. So being the marginal energy, we can be covered over either by in our full transcendental constitutional position, or we can be covered over by Maya. So this is, I guess, the status quo of being Krishna's servant is always there. And then there's another aspect to sambandha gyan, which is what is our specific relationship with Krishna, eternally and internally. And this can be of five rasas. So Lord Chaitanya gives Tapan Mishra this knowledge of sambandha gyan, and which aspect of our relationship with Krishna we are engaging or connecting with depends very much on where we are at in our spiritual life. So we know our different stages. Some of you may be familiar, moving from Shraddha through to Prem, there are 9 stages. So depending on where we are at in those stages, we will be cultivating a different aspect of our relationship with Krishna. But the goal is always, as we know, is to love Krishna. So whether it's with the activities in this body we are expressing our love, because if you look at all our activities, everything we do, whether it's our work, whether it's deity worship, whether it's serving devotees, whether it's honoring prasadam or offering bhoga, we are trying to express or understand or reconnect with loving Krishna. And then internally, again, depending on where we are at with understanding our sambandha or relationship with Krishna, we will be connecting with his love in a different way. But then very at the crux of all of this, if you want to achieve a goal and you want to understand your relationship with that goal, you have to have some activities, right, to be able to achieve it. So this is Abhideya. Abhideya, our activities, our 9 processes of devotional service, and which is the most important? It is the chanting. So this chanting or the activities of any goal or process is what brings it alive. Right? If we didn't have our activities, if we didn't know how to achieve the goal of loving Krishna or how to understand our relationship with him, then it would be a pretty dry philosophical process. It would sound nice. Oh, look, there's this person who loves us so much, unconditionally, and we are eternally his servant. But when we fully surrender, he becomes our servant, much like parents do to their own children. They become their servant, even though everything actually belongs to the parent. But if we don't understand how to achieve this, then it's flat, isn't it? It's very flat because we're thinking, okay, well, that sounds really good, but how do I make it real? So Abhideya is very, very important. So we're on the section of Lord Chaitanya's, I guess, conclusion of his interactions with Tapan Mishra. And the CC is now telling us, you know, in this way, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu contributed the greatest benefit to the people of East Bengal by initiating them into Harinam, the chanting of the Hare Krishna Mahamantra, and making them learned scholars by educating them. So it's being highlighted here that actually a learned scholar, definition of a learned scholar, is somebody who has the highest knowledge, right? Somebody who has the best knowledge, the knowledge that can be applied in all times, in all places, in all circumstances, despite what your culture is, your age, your background. We're always hearing this throughout Srila Prabhupada's books. It doesn't matter what statements he might quote from the Vedas sometimes, because sometimes we hear contradictory statements in the Srimad Bhagavatam, right? Especially about the body. You know, you might read in the Srimad Bhagavatam that having a particular type of birth is considered lower or higher, or a certain skin color, or a certain type of wealth, or a certain type of body. But actually, when we understand all of this and what's underlying it, these things are just describing the bodily platform. Just like amongst vehicles, you'll have different degrees of, I guess, what would be considered better and worse. You know, you might have your Skoda compared to your Mercedes, you might have your Ferrari compared to, you know, whatever, they're all different. But they all have a purpose. So our bodies are all different. You know, one can get quite offended if they take some of the bodily statements in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And I've known people to put away the Bhagavatam or put away transcendental literature when they get caught up in things about the bodily platform. But if you actually dive in and you read Srila Prabhupada's purport, one thing that is very universal and comes up again and again and again, and with every book, if you read even Srila Prabhupada's introduction, you'll see that he did this amazing thing. He would write each paragraph as if it might be the last paragraph he'll ever write, or it might be the only thing the person ever reads, right? He would give everything in that paragraph, or enough for us to take away what we need to understand who Krishna is or what Krishna consciousness is. There's a really interesting pastime when the Maha Mantra in the 70s became like, I think it was 70s or late 60s, became a hit record, and it was played on Top of the Pops. And devotees managed to, I think, get Srila Prabhupada a slot to speak. Remember when I was young and Top of the Pops would be on then, they would always have the groups come on stage on the live show. So I think the devotees were going for that to perform the kirtan. And I think initially Srila Prabhupada had been given quite a long time to explain Krishna consciousness. But by the time the show happened, his time had been reduced to a very short, I think 3 minutes or something. And so devotees were concerned. This is all in Prabhupada memories. They said to Prabhupada, we're so sorry, you know, they've reduced our time down to 3 minutes. And Prabhupada said, don't worry. Even if I have 1 minute, I can give them all of Krishna consciousness, because he was so expert. But the one thing he would always emphasize is that the process, the Abhideya, and this comes from Lord Chaitanya, is there's no hard and fast rules. It can be chanted any time, any place, by anyone, initiated, not initiated, whether you have full knowledge, no knowledge, whether you have faith or no faith. Of course, what results you get depend on your understanding and your faith, because when we understand something and when we have faith in the process, we engage with it better, right? Which is why we have Sambandha Gyan, which is why we have Prayojana. So to Tapan Mishra, he gives him the full knowledge, because Tapan Mishra isn't just somebody that Lord Chaitanya is looking to just plant a seed. What he's looking to do is, well, I want Tapan Mishra to become a leader and then go to Varanasi and spread the holy names. So to lead, you need to understand the whole process, and not just understand it, but be so passionately connected with it that you can give it to others. And not just passionately connected with it, but actually achieving the results. Okay, so this is unanimous. This is throughout the Vedic literature, is this process, or the Abhideya, this chanting of the holy names. I wanted to share something, because in this purport, Srila Prabhupada says, we are giving people an immense treasury of transcendental literature translated into all the important languages of the world. And he expresses that this literature is selling profusely. But before even giving the literature, the first thing Srila Prabhupada did when he came to the Bari is he sat and chanted. He didn't give class. He just did kirtan with his cartels, right? That's the first thing he distributed was the holy name. And he says in this purport that following the footsteps of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Krishna consciousness movement is distributing the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Then he talks about the book. So I wanted to just share something, a quote from the Padma Purana, and actually Srila Prabhupada's translation of what the Maha Mantra means from this quote. This is a verse from the Padma Purana. Namachintamani Krishna Chaitanya Rasa Vigraha Purna Shuddho Nitya Mukto Binatvan Nama Nami Noho.
So the actual translation in the Padma Purana is the holy name of Krishna is transcendental wish-fulfilling gem, Chintamani. It is the embodiment of all consciousness and sentiments. It is complete. It is pure. It is ever free because the name of Krishna and Krishna himself are one and the same. So Srila Prabhupada expands. Actually, his translation is, the holy name of Krishna is transcendentally blissful. It bestows all spiritual benedictions, for it is Krishna himself, the reservoir of all pleasure. Krishna's name is complete, and it is the form of all the transcendental mellows. It is not a material name under any condition, and it is no less powerful than Krishna himself. Since Krishna's name is not contaminated by the material qualities, there is no question of it being involved with Maya. Krishna's name is always liberated and spiritual. It is never conditioned by the laws of material nature. This is because the name of Krishna and Krishna himself are identical. He actually gives this translation to this verse from the Padma Purana in CC, in Madhya Lila, in the 17th chapter. And I guess the analogy he uses, and Prabhupada was very expert at using analogies, and something we can, I think devotees, we do as well. It's a nice way to reframe what can be quite a complex and deep concept into something that's digestible. So the analogy he gives to describe this is like, or the explanation, comparison he gives is, so in the material world, if you call something by its name, it doesn't mean it's manifest, right? So if you're thirsty, and I say to you, just drink water, just say water. Just say water, 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 water over again. You think that's going to cut it? It's not really, is it? You know, or if you're missing someone, if you just say their name, yes, you maybe feel a little satisfaction because by saying their name, you might recover some memories, recall some memories, and then that leads to so many other things. But it's not the same. But what Prabhupada explains is actually spiritual names and words, they are non-different to the person. So when we call Krishna's name, he is fully present. If we are not experiencing his full presence, then that's because there is some obstruction or block on our side. Okay, so it's just like if we want to go out in the rain and get wet, but we hold up an umbrella, the rain is there, but it's not going to affect us. It's not going to wet us. So similarly, we have to be looking at, well, what are umbrellas? What are the different barriers we put up? And actually, this is interesting because I think this verse very much talks about preaching. Really focus on what Prabhupada brings it back to is, you know, we are a preaching movement. That's what Lord Chaitanya wanted. It's not that just we become Krishna conscious, but we become like Tapan Mishra, qualified to a point where we can share Krishna consciousness with others. And actually, it serves us to understand what our deficiencies are in not connecting with the holy name, because when we understand our deficiencies, we also then can be more realistic about what might be other people's obstacles and difficulties with connecting to the process and the holy name. And then we connect with them on a very realistic level because we bring ourselves to that interaction, whether it's because we're giving class, or whether it's a one-to-one, whether it's just explaining a very simple concept like prasadam, which actually people very much want to have. So this idea that we understand what our obstruction is really, really important. Just an example, a nice story that illustrates this in terms of obstructions and blocks, and something that can help our preaching is, it's very hard to offer someone something when they don't recognize its value. Okay, our biggest barrier for us with our chanting is our mind, right? Our mind always finds something more important than chanting, even while we're chanting. Even while the words are coming out of our mouth, the mind often goes to something else because the mind thinks something else is valuable. The mind hasn't yet been trained to really understand what the holy names mean. So, again, similarly, this is also when we approach other people. So there's a nice pastime that illustrates this. So there's
there's a pastor of a disciple asking their guru, you know, what is the most confidential aspect of bhajan? And the guru replies, chanting the Maha Mantra. And so this disciple, he starts to go around the village and, he starts to share this. And he actually realizes, well, so many people know how to chant the Maha Mantra. It can't be that, confidential. He goes back to his guru, he says, well, what is this? You told me the most confidential aspect of bhajan is to chant Krishna's name, is to actually call him by his name. But everybody seems to know this. How is it confidential? And his guru says, okay, take this. And he gives him a jewel, a raw, uncut jewel. And he says, go, take it to all these people that you say know the, most confidential aspect of bhajan. Take it all over the village, see what happens. So, he goes first to the washer people who he'd asked about the most confidential bhajan, who knew what the Maha Mantra was. And he said, would you like this? It's very valuable. Said, yes, this is brilliant. We can scrub our clothes with it. Thank you. And he says, okay, no, it's not for scrubbing clothes, And then he goes to the women, who are making huts out of cow dung, and he shows it to them. And he says, look, he says, would you like this? It's very valuable. It could change your life. It's very expensive. And then they look at it. Yeah, I don't see how it'll change my life, but we can use it to help us flatten the patties to make the huts. And so in this way, he's going around, he realizes, oh, okay, so this message that people don't always understand the value of what they're being given. And sometimes it is a preacher's almost part of our endeavor in preaching, to help people to understand what the value of something is. Now, if you look at this jewel, why didn't they recognize the value? Because it was raw. It was uncut. It wasn't polished. When we first start chanting, because of our blocks, we are experiencing the raw, uncut experience of japa, which is that the mind gets disturbed. Sometimes we think, in the beginning it's wonderful. We're on a high because all this prasadam and devotees and knowledge and chanting, it's like, wow, this is amazing. But then when we've been practicing for a little while, we start to maybe focus on the ragged edges of the gem. So this raw uncut gem, we start to forget that actually the reason I can't see it is because I'm not polishing myself, I'm not polishing the outside, I'm not polishing the aspect of me that can really experience and that can really connect. So the mind is constantly going to other things, thinking they are more valuable. How can I use the holy name for something else? We look at our offenses. Many of the 10 offenses are to do with using the holy name for something else, maintaining material attachments while still knowing so much, mistaking the holy names to be some sort of fruitive activity, considering the holy names to be the same as the demigods. So these things are very much distractions. They're like saying, okay, well, I'll use the raw uncut gem to, flatten my cow patties or to scrub the clothes. So this understanding that, do we value, do we know what it is that we have and what it is that we are trying to distribute? It's extremely important. The other thing I wanted to look at also was this idea that what does our chanting mean? Or what is the purpose of our chanting? I don't want to just speak for an hour. I would like to hear your thoughts. What was the purpose of our chanting? When someone asks you, why do you chant? I know we've heard it brings alive our goal of loving Krishna establishes our relationship with him. But why else? What's the purpose of our chanting? And does our purpose with our chanting vary? Is it different for different devotees? This is where you speak.
More chanting?
Okay. But why? Oh, chant to develop taste for more chanting? Okay. Prabhu? We chant for service, nice. Purification, lovely, okay. Purification, what does that mean? If I was coming to the temple for the first time, how would you explain purification? What are we being purified of? Purify our heart of what? Again, I'm new. What is that dirt? I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I think we get used to using certain words and we forget sometimes what they mean. Okay. Anybody else want to say something about the dirt, Prabhu? To please Krishna. Nice. Sunil? Okay, so to purify ourselves of qualities that we might want to remove or don't like about ourselves. Can you say a little bit more?
That's why I was saying, to give specific examples, that sometimes I experience anger or frustration or a sense of greed. In the process of the mantra meditation, you can focus our mind on the mantra, and then slowly these qualities that we have within us will start to be.
Okay, nice. Prabhu, you pick. Okay. Why are we actually trying to remove it, though? Just because we don't like it? I mean, there's plenty of people who walk around with those things and they're like, yeah, I'm fine. I like being greedy. Good. So they act as an obstacle. And how does that obstacle manifest in our chanting? How do we know there are obstacles still there? How do these obstacles manifest in our chanting? How do we know what's different about chanting when the obstacles are there and when the obstacles are not there? Okay, so we're not experiencing the Lord. Also, even before that, because experiencing the Lord directly comes later. We have no taste for chanting. Again, how does that manifest? Inattention.
We start thinking along the lines of those six things. So if we have lust in our hearts, for example, we want to enjoy.
Okay, while we're chanting, outside of chanting. Okay, so what does that do to our chanting other than make it inattentive? Offensive. What else? It's unsteady, isn't it? Up until nishtha, our practice, particularly our chanting, is unsteady. Unsteady, perhaps in the quantity, but definitely unsteady in the quality. Yes, we're not always not. I mean, connecting or realizing Krishna's name as Him, experiencing Him through the name is one thing. But to even get to a point where we're experiencing some steadiness with the japa in quantity and quality. Is these obstacles are usually the main things, that these are anarthas that we're trying to remove. Yes? So what the goal of our chanting is, nobody has mentioned a goal which is wrong. They're all correct goals. But the goal of our chanting will be different at different stages. So service is always there. We're always asking for service. But in the pre-nishtha stages, so before we get to ruchi, which is taste, the service we are generally asking for is service here, isn't it? We want our services here to go well. We want to be steeped in service. We want to have family and work life, which is steeped in service, etc., etc. And then as we progress, that the nature of that service changes, not just in terms of our motives behind external service, but also internal service, as we then start to understand our sambandha, internal sambandha, and develop more love. So definitely service is there. But also an important goal with our chanting in the beginning is to achieve steadiness. Yes? Agreed? Or disagreed? Okay, agreed. So this Naam Bhajan, or systematically cultivating the chanting of the holy names, it is important
for us to have some understanding of what we're trying to achieve with our chanting. Yes, we want service. Yes, we want to undergo Nartha Nivritti. But before we even can do that effectively, we want some steadiness with our chanting. So we have three stages of chanting. The most basic stage of chanting is Namaparad, which means offensive chanting. So at the offensive start chanting stage, we have that jewel, we're holding it, but we are definitely using it to flatten cowpat. Okay? Because we are so distracted by our stuff that we find it even difficult to endeavor to bring our mind back to the chanting, yes? So we don't really benefit from the jewel. We don't really understand what jewel we have. It feels like this is hard. If I don't get my rounds done, I can't even think about anything else. And we hold the anxiety all day and carry it all day rather than actually sit down and chant. It's amazing how much time we will waste thinking about chanting than actually chanting, right? Everybody's going to nod, because anybody who's serious about chanting will be honest that that's happened to them. So Namaparad is the offensive stage of chanting, always an effect, because a hot iron rod will always have an effect. But because we're so inattentive to it, we don't really notice or experience or connect. So the next stage is a bit more affected, Namabhas, which means shadow chanting, which actually means. So yes, the difference between Namabhas and Namaparad is we are constantly endeavoring to bring our mind back to the chanting. That is the difference. You know, it's interesting. We, especially living in the Western world, especially in Kali Yuga, this idea of endeavor is not, it's not really given much attention. We're very goal-orientated. We're not endeavor-orientated, right? We see this through advertising, through our technology, smartphones, iPads, smart screens, everything. Everything is, how quickly can I get to the end result? Okay, even our social media is geared towards, how quickly can I get to the end result of showing the whole world that I'm popular? You know, this idea that 100 likes on Facebook, well, that is better than having 5 real friends, because nobody knows about my 5 real friends, but everybody can see I have 100 likes. Okay, so we're very much orientated towards results. How can I get the result as quickly as possible? But actually, you look at Bhagavad Gita, what Krishna says to Arjuna about, you know, actually you have a right to perform your duty. That's the endeavor. But the results, you do not have a right to those. They're bestowed by me. So don't automatically assume that you have a right to the result. You can try. That's your right. The endeavor is your right. The action, to perform the action, to engage your free will, is your right. Absolutely. Place your endeavor wherever you want to place it. But result, not yours. Okay, don't expect it. And sometimes the result will be greater than your endeavor. So this idea that Namapas is endeavoring to constantly bring the mind back to chanting. That's all Krishna's asking. Because at Namapas, we make very quick progress. Because what Krishna's saying, oh, you're trying. You're deciding to place your free will and your endeavor in trying to see the value of the raw, uncut jewel. Okay, at the moment you're still experiencing raw. But you know what? Because you're trying, I will sit with you. I will stay with you. I'll spend a little long with you because you're trying to be with me. You're trying to understand me. And so then these obstacles that we have, the 6 that you described, they go very quickly. Yeah, it's like cleaning a room attentively and cleaning it absentmindedly. And if you, when you were little and your parents tried to get you to clean, if you did it inattentively, if they gave you a mirror and you just, they come and they're like, I don't think you cleaned this properly. You missed a bit here, you missed a bit here. Yeah, but then when they mean something to you and you think, you know, I really want to please my parents. I don't really know how to clean this, you know, but I'm going to try. And they try and maybe imitate, or they try and follow maybe some instructions, and you try and do that. And you're a bit more careful. You might get distracted because you can hear your brothers and sisters playing. You think, they're playing, or they're watching TV. They sound like they're having fun, and I'm here cleaning this mirror, you know. But you try. And your parents see you've tried because they can watch you. They can see, oh, I know, I can see that he or she is getting distracted, but they're still bringing their focus back. They're still trying. We're so happy. We'll give them their pocket money anyway. Okay, so this is how the holy name works at the Namabhas stage. That Krishna says, okay, you're trying, so I will reward you for trying. And then because we're not shooting ourselves in the foot with the offenses, because we're not
kind of going two steps forward and one step back, we start to make progress. And we reach a stage where the anartha nivritti happens very quickly. And we go from unsteady chanting or unsteady bhajana kriya and practices to achieving a steadiness. And then that steadiness becomes fixed. Has anybody ever worked on a, what's the best example I can give? On a loom, like a spinning loom? So when you, or turned a wheel of any sort, or even cycling. Okay, when you first start, it's unbalanced, isn't it? You're still trying to kind of balance your weight, your direction. Namaprad. And then you start to make focus a bit more. Before, you're just bound by fear. Look, I'm scared. I'm going to fall. Hold the back seat. You know, this is where fear gets in the way. This is namaprad. One of the biggest obstacles out of the six is fear. All of the others are rooted in fear. It says this in Srimad Bhagavatam, that all of our six enemies of the mind, actually, at their base, they have fear. That's the first one. Yeah, greed comes from a fear of what? There isn't enough. Yeah, envy also. Yes, anger. Fear that I won't get what I want, or I haven't got what I want. So fear is always at the root. So this fear stops us from being steady on the cycle. Then we say, okay, I'm not so scared. I understand balance. There's someone here who's got my back. Guru's got my back. Let me try. And so then we start to find our feet. You know, but it's hard work. Oh, your thighs hurt. You think, my little legs, can they really pedal fast enough? Because you find, actually, if I pedal a little faster, it's easier to balance. If I gain, then you gain momentum. Yeah? And this is steady. You gain some steadiness. But eventually, that you gain such momentum, you don't have to actually pedal that much. Right? There's some hills that go down, and you're going, oh, wow. No hands, you know? And no pedaling. I'm just speeding along. So this is when our steadiness becomes that kind of, okay, it's just there. That's nishtha. Okay, it's an effortless steadiness. It's no longer fighting. You know, we're just cruising. It's cruise control on your bike. Yeah. So nishtha is cruise control with our practice. Our practice and our faith is at cruise control. And then next stage is. Oh, sorry, not after nishtha. I mean, in terms of chanting. Shudnam, which means? Pure chanting. So how is that different? So no unwanted qualities in your chanting, so it's offenseless. So what is your experience? What is the experiencer of shudnam experiencing? You're shaking your head because you're experiencing it right now, or you don't know? Anybody know? To do with devotion. Okay, what would we hope is that when we're experiencing the pure name, when that jewel we're holding is polished and uncut, what's happening? So name, form, qualities, pastimes, everything is manifesting. The name is coming fully alive. Just like Prabhupada says, we are drinking the water. We are experiencing the water. So this is really nice. So this idea that, you know, following in the footsteps of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Krishna consciousness movement is distributing the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra and inducing people all over the world to chant. We are giving everybody this abhidaya, this process, maybe even before we give them the sambandhagyan, maybe even before we give them prayojana, right? We see so many different wonderful ways that devotees are sharing Krishna consciousness because people are still interested in packaging. I'm sure if that disciple that we're talking about who took the raw uncut diamond or jewel around and people weren't recognizing it, if you put it in a nice box, people would suddenly think, wow, this is wonderful. I won't just use it to flatten my cow patties. I will put it on my shelf and worship it because it's in a nice box. I don't know what's inside, but the box is pretty, right? How much of advertising and shopping is so dominated by packaging? People buy the packet first before the product. It's every advertiser's main focus. You know, some of my patients are big head execs of big advertising companies, and they say, we just focus on the outside. We leave the substance to the manufacturer. All we look at is the outside. If we can sell the outside,
then that product will be a success. It doesn't matter what's inside. Okay? Now, we're fortunate. Our product is perfect. We're selling perfection, but not everybody recognizes perfection. So it's kind of some weird kind of paradox, if that's the right word, but we're covering the perfection with imperfection to attract people's imperfect senses. So then they come and they see the imperfection, think, oh yes, this is nice. Prabhupada, you know, this is nice, and let's go for that imperfection. But then they open up the box and they realize they're connecting with something actually is much greater than the packaging. Yeah, this is how you know good quality product. Anybody here ever bought a really good quality product where they were really bowled over by the packaging, but actually when they looked inside the packaging, the product was even better? Anybody? Don't be shy. It's okay to have some opulence. Share if you have. Sunil, have you? He's smiling. He's got an example. Go on. But it's slick. Okay, so everybody else does it. That attracts you.
No.
If no one queued up for the iPhone, would it be as appealing?
I guess it creates a desire because people like to follow.
Okay. But they created a packaging that people would want to follow. And the product itself, does it live up to the packaging or does it exceed it?
I think it exceeds the packaging.
Exceeds the packaging. Okay. So that's a high quality product, is it exceeds the packaging. So this is what we have. We have the holy names, which doesn't matter how we package the holy names, doesn't matter how we package Sambandhigyan or Prayojana, how we present it, even if we're using Maya to convert the Maya into transcendence, what we have is a high quality product. And if we remember that, then when it comes to preaching, we don't get lost in the packaging. Yes? We often hear that Prabhupada would always pray. Whenever he'd go to very, you know, wealthy homes, with celebrities, wherever he was going, if he knew that there was a lot of imperfect packaging around, or he had to do some sort of packaging. Actually, Prabhupada was pretty direct. But he would always pray that he wasn't distracted by this packaging. Now, we're not Srila Prabhupada, but we want to follow. We should also always pray. But aside from prayer, if we understand the value of what it is we're giving, the superficial things that sometimes we have to engage with in order to deliver it to others, we don't get distracted by it. Yeah, otherwise then we're the postman who steals the package because they just like the outside rather than the inside. We don't want to be that, right? So I wanted to actually have a discussion a bit more on are you laughing at the postman who steals the package? Fake iPhones. Okay, with the same packaging. Yeah, they do that with fragrances as well, right? With everything, I think. There's the Chinese version. Counterfeit. But there are plenty of people. There's a market for it. There's a market for counterfeit bhakti. There's a market for counterfeit devotion, right? There's a market for counterfeit spirituality. Cheaters want to be cheated. And they just satisfy themselves with the idea that what I've got will do. But then you're shortchanged because your cheap fragrance, it might initially smell the same, but it doesn't last very long, right? Yes, your cheap iPhone doesn't last very long. Every other counterfeit. So counterfeit devotion doesn't last very long. Person gets a feel-good for a little while, then gone. And in fact, they might end up in a worse situation than before. You look at cheap perfumes, you can be left with a rash. Yeah, right? Some people have used cheap perfumes, yeah, maybe. Counterfeit iPhones. You might get an electric current. It might not be safe. Yes? Counterfeit devotion, you commit offenses. And you may be blocked off for lifetimes from actually accessing the real stuff. So we have to be very careful. So I want to carry on with this. There's so much in this purport. We are giving people an immense treasury of transcendental literature.
translated into all the important languages of the world. And by the grace of Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, this literature is selling profusely. And people are chanting the Hare Krishna Mahamantra with great delight. This is the preaching process of the Chaitanya cult. Prabhupada proudly uses the word cult. We run away from the word cult. We're not a cult. We're not a cult. We're an old, traditional, ancient religion, you know, steeped in antiquity. Yes, we are. But cult, Prabhupada says it as is. Cult is just short for culture. Yes, we are trying to reframe and recreate and revolutionize human culture. Human culture at the moment is about scratch my back and you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. Human culture at the moment is about dog eat dog. Human culture at the moment is about me, myself and I. Right? But we're revolutionizing it to mean I'll serve you even if you don't serve me. I'll love you even if you don't love me. It's not about me, myself and I. It's about us. It's about we. It's about you. That's really different thinking, isn't it? I might have told this before in class, but I'll tell it again because I don't give class that often. There's a Christian story about heaven and hell. And I can't remember the details of the names of the saints, but a very good Christian dies. And, you know, he's picked up by the angels. And they say, you know, you're so special, you can choose where you want to go. So we'll show you hell first. So he's taken to hell. And hell's amazing. Beautiful. He's shocked. He's like, wow, it's amazing here. All opulence, wonderful, beautiful, natural, smells wonderful, sounds are wonderful. If this is hell, what's heaven like? You know? But then they take him through different rooms, different places. They take him to the dining room. And when they take him to the dining room, he sees that everybody's got really long spoons, really, really long handles. But they have every dish they can possibly imagine. He's saying, this is amazing. Look at this banquet. You know, I could stay in hell. I don't even know if I need to check out heaven. But what he notices is everybody at the table is miserable. Why? Because they're trying to feed themselves. Have you ever tried eating with a really long spoon? And they're getting nothing in their mouth. So the angel says, come on, let's go visit heaven. Gets to heaven, he's thinking, oh, I'm so excited. Heaven must be amazing, must be so awesome, because if hell was like that, heaven must be amazing. Gets to heaven, he's thinking, it looks exactly the same. Maybe it's just the entrance. Go through some other rooms, go and see him. No. Pretty much the same. Nothing's different. Let's go to the dining room. Same banquet, same long spoons. What's the difference? But what he notices is everybody's content and happy and plump. They're not skinny and angry and disturbed. Why? What they've figured out is they're feeding each other. Okay. So we're revolutionizing, you know, this by the chanting of the Maha Mantra. And prophets, I love this. Prophets saying people are chanting with great delight. You know, if you see on Harinam, it doesn't matter if people have no clue what we're saying. Yeah, you get the odd, you know, person who's a bit disturbed. But most people are really happy seeing the Hare Krishnas dancing around in bed sheets, you know, down the street. Some colorful, bed sheets are a bit more colorful now than they used to be, you know, and saris and things like that. I remember reading in Radha Damodara Vilas that back in the 60s and 70s, devotees all wore yellow, right? They all wore yellow or white. Whereas now we have so much variety, not just in our clothing, we have so much variety with our shastra as well. So Maha Mantra with great delight. This is the preaching process of the Chaitanya cult. Since the Lord wanted this cult preached all over the world, the International Society of Krishna Consciousness is acting in a humble way so that the vision of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu may be fulfilled all over the world, especially in the Western countries. You know, this really struck me that that ISKCON is acting in a humble way. Prabhupada didn't say, I'm acting in a humble way. He says that the movement. What does that mean? I want to hear from you. What do you take away from acting? How do we preach as a movement in a humble way? What does that mean? How can an organization be humble? Okay, so Prabhupada said that humility is being fearless for Krishna. So as a movement, are we fearless for Krishna? or we're still held back by institutional fears. That's really nice. Thank you. Giving respect to others and expecting nothing in return. So as an organization, not just as an individual, are we giving respect to others and expecting nothing in return? Prabhupada did that. There's lots of anecdotes of his disciples describing how when Prabhupada, especially when he first came, they didn't recognize what a sadhu was. They didn't know how to treat the spiritual master. On his first Vyasa Puja, they prepared nothing. Prabhupada told them it's Vyasa Puja tomorrow. And he shows up and there's nothing. No one's cooked. There's no garland. Nothing. You know what he did? He taught them how to do everything. He taught them how to make the garland. He taught them how to cook. And then the next day they had proper Vyasa Puja. Okay? So this, and he was asked, you know, Prabhupada, you know, these people are so rude to you. Why don't you say anything? So Prabhupada would always, he says, you know, one has to tolerate. There is some reason this person is behaving like this, I have to tolerate. Rather than re-engaging with that karmic cycle. You tolerate, it gets cut. You react, then they react, then you react, then they react, and the cycle goes on and on. We're back on that bicycle again, you know, but a different kind, a karmic bicycle, not a japa one. So giving respect to others. Do we do that as an organization? You know, now, we can't sit here and speak for the entire organization, but we make up the organization, and each and every one of us, the more fearless we are, the more respectful we are, the more the organization becomes like that. Because all of us, and no single person in this room is less or more important. Every single one of us has the power and potency to transform the culture and imbibe this movement, this organization with this humility of preaching. So what else? How else does this look? To act in a humble way so that the vision of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu may be fulfilled all over. I mean, Trinadapi Sunicha Nai is taken to another level in this purport. It's not just I'm as an individual humbler than a blade of grass and more tolerant than a tree, but our movement, can it be humbler than a blade of grass and more tolerant than a tree? So, and this is the secret to be able to getting everybody to chant the holy names so that Lord Chaitanya's desire can be fulfilled all over the world. So what else? How can we be humble as a movement? Can you say that one more time? I'm sorry. Okay. Okay, so that's nice. So not taking credit. Okay. So can we influence the planet without taking credit? So can ISKCON be effective on the planet without people knowing ISKCON is being affected on the planet? Okay, spiritual espionage. Nice. Okay. Anyone else? Hmm. Okay, so material growth. So you're saying specifically we're not concerned about our material growth. Is it material growth you're talking about, or just...
As a byproduct,
material may grow. Okay. Priority is other people's spiritual growth. Okay, but we don't neglect, right? Yeah. Because even as individuals, we have to take care of ourselves. Yeah, I mean, actually... So Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj was personally instructed by Prabhupada on the purpose of preaching. And when he was preaching in behind the Iron Curtain, you know, university programs that we do now, they've been going on for decades. Right? We're not pioneers of university programs. I know we have a lot of university programs, but we're not pioneers of the university preaching program. It was being done a long time ago. When Maharaj would preach behind the Iron Curtain, he said, because he would write to Srila Prabhupada every single day, even if he didn't send the letters. He says this was very helpful to him because then after Prabhupada left the planet, he wasn't so disturbed because he felt he still had a strong relationship with him. So anyway, so he remember he's saying that he was sharing that he wrote to Srila Prabhupada, saying to Prabhupada, you know, because he was a bit disgruntled. Sometimes he'd go to the colleges or universities and very few people would turn up, sometimes lots. He said, Prabhupada, you know, sometimes hardly anybody turns up. I'm thinking maybe we should wind down the college preaching. And Prabhupada said, no. The primary reason you preach is for your own purification. And even if nobody shows up, you preach to the walls, because that is your primary reason to preach. So in terms of this ISKCON, preaching or sharing this cult in a humble way, I think if we hold on to the idea that we benefit by sharing as an organization and as an individual, that we invite all auspiciousness to our organization by sharing the actual transcendental knowledge in a humble way, in a compassionate way, in a fearless way, in a way that's digestible, yeah, according to time, place, and circumstance, because this is what Prabhupada wanted. This is what Lord Chaitanya wanted. It's actually really the only way to give it to everybody, because that's how Krishna gives himself to everybody, many, many ways. Then we can act in a humble way. But the other two reasons, of course, after purification, there's sharing realization, and there's also sharing according to time, place, and circumstance. So, you know, we often get asked, you know, how are we an effective preacher? If we hold on to this primary principle that it's for my purification first, we then begin to put aside our stuff, because it stops being about how do I look, how am I presenting in terms of presenting myself or presenting us as an organization. And it becomes more about how am I growing from this. Because ultimately, the purer we are, the more effective we are. Right? The delivering a package to someone is just, the person who's delivering it is just as important as the package itself. You can have the perfect iPhone in the perfect iPhone box, high quality, but if your person who's delivering it to you is distracted, is lost, doesn't understand how expensive and valuable what they're delivering is, they don't understand how important the person they're delivering it to is, and they don't understand how important their role in delivering is, then the package might not get there, because there'll be so many distractions along the way. If you don't think you're important and that you'll benefit from that transaction, then you might not feel worthy of delivering it. If you don't understand how important what you're delivering is, then if it drops or you lose it, you might not care. If you don't understand, or we don't understand, how important the person we're delivering it to is, we may just want to enjoy it for ourselves. Okay? Or if they're not in, we may not try very hard to make sure it gets to them. But when we understand all of these three things, then it doesn't matter if you're preaching with a PowerPoint presentation, or a big rock concert in Hyde Park, or a simple one-to-one conversation, or even a general chat about gardening. It doesn't matter, because the vehicle that you're using, you know, it's just a medium. Does that make sense? So these three things all have to be understood for us to be able to act in a humble way. It's very important for us to understand the value of something for us to be humble. Yeah, Bhakti Jaroswami describes it really nicely. He gives the example of a tree which is bearing fruit. A tree bows down naturally when it's very full of fruit. So when we're very full, we are naturally humble, because we think, because we realize, my gosh, this is so valuable. How do I have it? How do I get to even not just have it, but have the privilege of sharing it with someone else? Let me make sure that person gets it. Then we really care about them. Yeah? The last point I wanted to make about preaching was the balance between packaging and what's inside. The packaging will change in the next 10 years, in 20 years, in 100 years, in 1,000 years. I was just having a realization recently that, you know, many of our most empowered souls in this movement, not just this movement, even amongst acharyas, were ahead of their time. Bhaktivinoda Thakur especially was very ahead of his time. You know, he was one of our first spiritual espionage leaders. You know, he wrote, he saw that at that time, the big Maya was, or the big cheating, or counterfeit bhakti was Sahajism. So he would write books for the Sahajas, but under a Sahaja name. So they accepted him. They accepted him. They read his books avidly, think, oh yeah, he's just like us. Right? So sometimes we may, but he didn't lose who he was. So sometimes we may have to dress differently. We may have to present ourselves differently. But we have to keep a balance. The reason we have to keep a balance is if we look at our acharyas and even devotees now who are empowered in terms of being very forward thinking, they are, may even be writing literature right now, which maybe is even too deep for the majority of devotees who are practicing now, or very forward thinking in terms of time, place and circumstance for the outside world. But transcendental literature isn't for just now, it's forever. And particularly in this 10,000 year golden age, we're just at the beginning. So many of the books that we have now, which might feel like, wow, why is this personality writing these books now? Who will read these books now? Are we really ready for these kinds of books? We might not be ready now, but those who are going to come after us and after them and after them and after them, they will be ready. You know, I was having this realization about many, many of our writers. I don't know if it's okay to share this or whether I'll get told off, but I'll share some things. So like Bhaktisiddhartha Maharaj's books is one example. I was thinking about Bhaktisiddhartha Maharaj and Shivram Maharaj's, you know, example. I was sharing this with you, some of you, earlier this week, that their books, they're writing are opposite ends of the spectrum. Yeah, you look at Bhaktisiddhartha Maharaj's books and he's very much writing for the secular world. At least some of his books are. And he's talking about a lot of worldly things, from terrorism to relationships, to the mind. And then you look at Shivram Maharaj's books, very rustic, very devotional, going to Leela, pastimes. He unpacks one verse over a whole chapter. And on the one hand, you could look at Bhaktisiddhartha Maharaj's books and go, you know, and I'm reading now, you know, he's written books in the 90s where he's referencing things that are happening now. So he's talking about children having phones and technology. We didn't have those things in the 90s. He knew, you know, about what's going to come in the next 20, 30 years. You know, he's talking about these, and mindfulness. In the 90s, people weren't doing mindfulness. Now mindfulness is popular. And he's talking about his book. You look at Shivram Maharaj's books, and I know there are devotees who are like, you know, because Shivram Maharaj really talks about, no, we must understand Nectar of Devotion and Srimad Bhagavatam and CC before we really dive into those books to understand them properly. But there, I know there are devotees who are probably thinking, you know, wow, these books are so deep. Are we really ready for them? But again, the vast majority maybe are not ready for them now, but in 10, 20, 50, 100 years, these books will still be there. So, you know, my request actually to all of you and every devotee's got some realization, some expertise they can bring, an angle, a packaging they can bring to the devotional process. Please be kind to the world. If through writing or speaking or some form, cooking, you can deliver that package of bhakti, please do it. Because it's not just about now, it's forever. It will be there. So we have some time for questions and comments.